Voters electing the city's first woman as mayor. Megan Berry already making plans.
As the first female running for mayor, did people give you a hard time?
Sure, there was a lot of sexism.
Where did it all go wrong?
There are three things that I love the most. My son, Max, my job, and my husband, Bruce. I lose my job. I had an affair with a person I worked with, my son. He started taking Xanax. We lose our son to a drug overdose.
That also affects marriages. How have you guys stayed together this whole time?
We made one decision, and that was the decision to not get a divorce.
I love that you wrote a book that you tell the whole story.
Yep.
You explain how to live your life again.
I want them to know that you can have a second chance, because it is what you do next. It's not what you did. It's right. What you do next.
Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. How do you survive the unthinkable twice? That's the question our guest today, Megan Berry, has had to answer in real time under the glare of public scrutiny with no space to grieve in peace. She was Nashville's first female mayor, a woman breaking barriers, building bridges, and transforming a city. But behind the headlines of progress in politics was a mother living a private nightmare, the sudden death of her only child, Max, to an accidental drug overdose. And just as she began to pick up the pieces, a scandal broke that would upend her life again. An affair with the head of her security detail that led to a criminal charge, a guilty plea, and ultimately her resignation from office. To the public, she became a punchline. But what's harder to see is the human underneath, the grieving mom, the woman carrying the guilt and shame, and the leader trying to reclaim her story. Not to excuse, but to explain. Today on Misunderstood, Megan Berry opens up about love, loss, power, addiction, and the impossibly high cost of being imperfect in the public eye. This isn't about politics, it's about humanity. Let's get into my conversation with Megan Berry. Megan Berry, thank you so much for joining me today on Misunderstood. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this.
Of course. So I want to, first of all, there may be people that know you for being the mayor of Nashville, for being the first, and I think only, right, mayor?
Yeah, so far. There.
Yeah, so far. And, but I want to start out from before that and
sure.
Find out a little bit how you got into politics. Where were you born? What was your childhood like? What did you want to be when you were little? That kind of thing.
Sure. All those things. So I was actually born in California. My dad was in the military. So he was stationed out there. But then we shortly moved to Kansas. And I basically grew up in Kansas, a very traditional, you know, mom stayed home, dad worked. I have three little sisters. Life was very wholesome.
I love it. I love it. And what got you into wanting to be involved in politics?
So, you know, I ran for office a couple of times when I was in fifth grade. And I still remember I'm running for office. I come home, I'm crying because I've lost. And my mom was the secretary, the room mother. And she's like, okay, Megan, we're at dinner. And, you know, I was doing the vote counting and I counted all the votes and I know your handwriting. And you didn't vote for yourself. You voted for your best friend. And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, well, your best friend didn't vote for you and you lost by one vote. And I was like,
no way.
All right. So, first lesson learned, you got to believe in yourself, because if you don't believe in yourself, you're never going to win. And I ran again in high school. Again, I thought it was a popularity contest, but my person I ran against actually had a platform. I lost again. And by the time I got to college, I ran in my sorority and I did win. But then, like most women, that was it. I was never going to run again. Politics aren't for women, at least they weren't back then.
Mm-hmm.
But I got involved locally in my child's PTO, in my neighborhood association, and you could really see the power of what people could do if they were actually engaged. We saved elementary school. And that kind of put me on the path then to run for office as a local official. I did that for 8 years. I was on our Metro Council as an at-large member. And then I decided I was going to run for mayor. And the whole time I was also in corporate America. I was really lucky that I had a company I worked for who saw this kind of as my public service. Uh-huh. So they let me do that too. I was an ethics and compliance officer for 20 years in healthcare and telecommunications.
And how did you get to Nashville? What brought you there?
Yeah, I came to Nashville because I came to Vanderbilt to get my MBA back in the 90s. Yeah, and I was going to do business. I mean, that's what I wanted to do. And I'll be here about 18 months and then I'll get the hell out of this town. And here I am 34 years later.
Right, exactly. So I'm curious, once you got to Nashville, did you start to realize what was going on there and you wanted to get involved? Did you feel like you had this platform that you would have used anywhere and you just wanted to be in politics in general? Like, what about Nashville made you kind of go the distance?
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually really do love this town. And so I wanted to make a difference here. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make a difference in the people's lives who lived here. And that was really what it was focused on. And government does that. And if it does it well, it matters. You know, your potholes get filled, your garbage gets picked up, and your fire, they get put out. So, you know, that was really important to me, to just have a functioning place that I lived.
Right. So yeah. When you were running for mayor, and especially we talked about it, but as the first female running for mayor there, was that an issue at all? Like, did people give you a hard time? Was that part of something that people spoke about, or was that no one even talked about it?
Well, you know, it's funny because I had spent some parts of my life in a different form where I had sold timeshare. And so I say that to say, like, it's a really good learning opportunity because what you figure out is how to pitch yourself to people. And you're always selling to the woman because she's going to make the decision in the House about who's going to vote and how they're going to vote.
Interesting.
Yeah. Because, you know, a whole lot of dynamics there. But so you're always, you know, you're always talking to the women. And so women were excited to see another woman putting themselves out there and making that decision. And that was great. And, I love campaigning because I love talking with folks, hearing their stories. Everybody has a story. And so, yeah. But there was a lot of sexism. I mean, the guy that I ran against, we're in the South, so let's just put that out there. Mm-hmm. I'm married to somebody who is not a Christian. And so he's Jewish. And so they did this whole they went on radio and did this whole thing about how if I won, my husband would really be the one in charge. And since he wasn't a Christian, you know, that was going to be bad news for Nashville.
Wow.
You never would have done that to a guy and talked about his wife's religion. So, I mean, there was lots
that
of
to me is really fascinating, though, that when you watch politics, that it's like a bad marriage in that all of a sudden it gets personal and they shoot, below the belt and something ridiculous comes out and people that, you know, that matters to, that becomes all that they talk about. And then it's no longer about who's better for the job, who's more experienced, who would make a difference. But you said something earlier that the women were helpful and excited. There are a group of women who are not happy for women. So did you run into that at all?
Not much. I mean, you know, I didn't find that in Nashville. I found that women really were happy and excited about having a woman run. And, and you know, we're a Democratic city in a very red state. And even though we all run nonpartisan, which honestly is the best thing, because then you are not beholden to a party. You may have beliefs that align with one party or the other, but Republicans and Democrats will feel okay to vote for the person as opposed to feeling like they have to vote for the party. And we'd probably be a lot better off if that was the way it was across the states.
I mean, it's interesting that politics is supposed to be built on ethics and things like that. And then there are so many things that are not about ethics and politics.
Sadly. I don't know how much you get into politics in you know, these kinds of conversations. Mm-hmm. But politics impacts all parts of our lives. Mm-hmm. And again, I go back to that you want a functioning government, which is why I was attracted to politics in the first place, to make sure that you have a city that runs and runs well and right. you like where you live. I mean, everybody right. wants that.
Yeah. So talk to me about the impact you felt like you had when you were mayor. What was the sure. biggest accomplishment you had that you're really proud of?
So I remember my first day when I had this amazing team. That is actually one of my, I think, my best accomplishments was I was able to bring these really smart people together to make a difference and to mm-hmm. put together some really cool stuff. And I can remember that first day when we're standing in the office and I'm like, okay, y'all, I had this counter on my phone, which I said, we have 1,421 days. Mm-hmm. That's all we got. So every day you have to be moving the needle on infrastructure, education, you know, social equity. I mean, all the things that we were trying to move in Nashville. And I think we did. We definitely did that. My time in office was cut short. So we definitely didn't make nearly as much progress as I wish that we had. And, you know, my sadness for my team, especially right. who right. didn't get to fulfill what they were doing.
Right. Yeah. Do you want to reflect on the $5.4 billion Nashville transit proposal?
Sure. Yeah. 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 Let's reflect on that.
Let's talk about it.
So at that point, okay. So one of our big initiatives was this huge transit piece that went to the voters. It got, you know, completely shot down. It also came, the vote came after I had left office. So, you know, there's probably a little bit of the tangled up of my scandal that also fed over into the transit vote. But it didn't lose by like a couple of points. If it had lost right. by a couple of points, then I would take all the blame. But right. it lost by a huge margin. So mm-hmm. we obviously hadn't done a good enough job all along selling it as the idea behind what we could do to make transit easier in Nashville. And they just had a transit initiative pass in November. So, you know, we've made now a little bit more progress since then. So that's the good news.
Right. Okay. So building up to this, it sounds like you spent your whole life kind of being interested in politics. Then you saw what it was like to make a difference. You're in office, you're yep. doing these great things. You have this great team. Where did it all go wrong?
Yeah. So it's 2015 and I have just been elected, and there are three things that I love the most in the world. They are my son, Max, who at the time was at college. He was a sophomore in college. My job, this great new job that I've just gotten as the mayor of Nashville, and my husband, Bruce. So those are the three things that I love the most. And by 2018, I have lost two of those. We lose over the course of that our son to a drug overdose. I lose my job because of my own personal failings. And by 2018, there is only one thing I can save, and that's my marriage to my husband. And so, you know, that's where I end up having the ability to focus. But to get there, you know, I make no excuses for what I did. I own everything I did. And I had an affair. I had an affair with a person I worked with. And so, you know, I was prosecuted by the district attorney for that. He alleged that theft. Now, he never actually accused me of theft. He accused the guy that I'd had the affair with because the guy had reported more hours on his time card than he says he'd really worked. And I said, hey, look, if I'm in charge, right? Like, if I'm the person in charge, and if he did that, well, then I'm responsible. So they did an audit later of the hours. I think after they looked at 1,000 hours, they found that there were like 12 hours that they couldn't account for for his time card. Right. But you know what?
So just on a sidebar, it's one thing to have a scandal about, you know, infidelity, which I feel like happens more often than not. And you hear about it, but I guess it became criminal in the way that they were charging for use of having this affair on company trips and accounting for hours that were not.
Which is also a kind of weird thing. You know, like I was the mayor, I worked 24/7. There wasn't a time when I right. didn't work. But again, you know, look, many times in situations like this, you know, people suffer consequences. I mean, look, I spent my whole 20 years in corporate America going around telling men to keep their dicks in their pants. So I totally get it that, like, the irony here. But, you know, usually you just lose your job.
Do you think if it wasn't, if it didn't become a criminal issue, would your constituents and the public, would they have been okay? And you would have stayed in office?
I don't know. I don't know if I was ever going to be able to stay like that. You know, it's so interesting to think through that. I mean, you know, we had just lost our son. So what I know now, which of course is because of grief, like I was, you could have like waved a red flag in front of me and I wouldn't have seen it because I was so devastated by the loss of our child.
Well, can we talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, okay? Please. Let's talk about Max.
I mean, you said he was one of the most, if not the most important thing to you. How close were you guys at this point?
So we were so close. Max is our only child. So he had gone, you know, and he had a type A personality mom. And by the time he's a junior in college, I'm pretty much busting his chops on what are you doing? Like, what are you doing after you graduate? And so he discovered Xanax. And he started taking Xanax, and Xanax is a really addictive drug for a 21-year-old. And you know, we could hear it in his voice that there was something wrong with him. So we were able to get him home, and like we had a lot of things that a lot of people don't have. We had access to resources. We had, you know, Max was willing to go to rehab, and there was a bed available, right?
Oh, so he did go to rehab.
He did, yeah. So he went to rehab the summer before his senior year, and you know, and that was great. I mean, I still remember when he landed here in Nashville when we got him home, and I took him immediately to Vanderbilt's emergency room, and you know, they took him back there, and you know, I'm like, the, you know, the mom that wants to know everything that's going on. And the doctor came back out and said, look, I can't tell you anything. Max won't sign the form. And Max would not let the doctor talk to me. And I go out now and talk to groups all the time about shame and how substance use disorder and shame go hand in hand. And for us that night, that was the most dangerous thing in that emergency room was Max's shame. He wouldn't even let me know. Now, if that doctor had said to him, hey, you got cancer, he would have signed the form and said, get my mom in here. Like, let's figure this out. But he didn't. Right. So the doctor just said, you got to go home and like tomorrow come back and pick him up and figure out what's next. And so,
so I just want to get into what you're saying about that, because that's actually really interesting that if it was a disease like a cancer, he would have had no shame because it would have been that happened to him. And instead, he really felt so much shame. He did not want you to know what he was going through. Yep. Obviously, probably what he was using. He obviously told he was going to tell you one thing when it probably wasn't the whole thing.
Absolutely.
And that ended up almost enabling him to continue it. Or what ended up happening from there? It wasn't something you could actually get in and help him with.
I couldn't. And you know, and just to put that in perspective, you know, I like the doctor says, like, you got to deal with this, come back and pick him up. And I'm like, I don't even know what we're dealing with.
Right.
So I go home and I get on Google and I start Googling and, you know, I'm looking up, I mean, I know it's drugs, but you know, I don't really know what's up. And at the time I was the mayor.
Right.
My shame, I didn't call anybody. I didn't call his pediatrician. I didn't call my mom. I didn't call anybody because I didn't want anybody to think that Max was an addict and I didn't want people to judge us.
Right.
So, you know, I was lucky though, when we picked Max up, I was able to get him a rehab bed and he went to rehab. He did rehab for a month. And at the end of that, we sent him back to his senior year in college. And Bruce, my husband and I both felt like we'd checked the box, right? Like he was fine. It was all good. We were never going to have to deal with this again. Yeah. Well, again, if we'd understood what substance use disorder is about. So, but he does, he graduates and it's all, you know, fine. And he's making his way back to Nashville and he stopped in Denver, Colorado. And he was hanging out with some friends on a back deck of somebody who was house sitting. And they got into the drug cabinet. And so to anybody that's listening, if you do have drugs in your cabinet that you don't have locked up, lock them up. It might not be your kid, but it could be somebody else's kid. And so Max was sitting there and his friends went out to get some food. And when they came back, Max was having a seizure. But they were 20-something-year-old boys. They didn't know what to do. So they threw water on him. They hoped it would help. Finally, they did call 911. And by the time the paramedics got there, Max was dead on the back deck. And he didn't have anything in his system alone that would have killed him. But because, again, he was almost a year clean and he hadn't been using, so he didn't have a tolerance. So the little bit of drugs that he did ingest killed him. And, you know, I still remember it at Max's memorial, my husband saying, you know, we do a lot of stupid shit in our lives. Most of it doesn't kill us. This time it did. I know. But so to families out there who are struggling with substance use disorder, there is hope. If we start treating this like the disease it is, we actually had 30,000 people last year who actually didn't, like, the number is down. So 30,000 more people lived from the numbers over time and did not die because of things like access to Narcan. And Narcan is something that you can carry with you. I carry it with me all the time. And if you ever see somebody that's overdosing, you can administer it. And if they're, it'll buy them time.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Wow. Well, first of all, Megan, I just want to tell you I'm so sorry
for
you and for your loss.
Thanks, Rachel.
I understand it from a different perspective. My father died of a cocaine overdose.
I'm so sorry.
He was 44 years old. And the one thing that, like, I just feel like in hearing this and knowing my own situation as a survivor of somebody that, you know, a family member that you're that close to, that, you know, there is the guilt that goes along. But those people feel like they're invincible and it could never happen to them. And they know what they're doing. And, you know, it's, I can remember when I was 11, being part of, you know, writing letters, you know, trying to get, you know, interventions to happen. And, you know, it's just really up to them, but that guilt that goes along and then the feeling after of, you know, replaying everything, what could I have said? What could have been different? You know, I also lost my fiance in the World Trade Center.
Yes, right, of course.
And you spend all this time when things like that happen in a tragic way, sort of floating through life like, oh, we should have been doing this or we, you know, and I couldn't get my act together because I kept living in the past. And the only way I've kind of gotten through it is number one with time, but like dealing with that guilt and the shame and the grief and also trying to understand that they lived the life that they needed to live then. And
that's
it's
right.
Our job to learn lessons from that, to show people how to continue to live, to, you know, show people what not to do so this doesn't happen to them and use their life as a lesson going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so sorry for your loss. I, you know, as a child, I can't imagine watching the adult in your life who you just don't. I mean, it's one thing as an adult to watch the child, but man, I'm so sorry.
And thank you. But also to watch my grandmother and how that affected her. She never got out of bed again. She lived another 20 years and literally stayed in her house because it devastated her that bad. So, I mean, not to harp on this whole subject, but that is, it can devastate people. And so, you know, it's just, I totally can understand what you're going through. I've seen it on both sides, my side and my father's mother, watching her go through it. And it's just indescribable for people that have not been through a loss like that. So I want to ask you, like, how, because that also affects marriages. I know your marriage has been through a lot.
Yeah.
So how have you guys stayed together this whole time?
Well, it's funny. We'll actually be married 32 years this fall. And well, hey, it's a process. Like, look, there's no magic sauce here. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you that when I had the affair and, you know, I had, you know, you have to do a lot of confessing when you're just getting ready to go on TV to confess to the world. You know, there's somebody you have to confess to first. And so I had to tell my husband and, you know, he was sad and I, but you know, the one thing though that he said is he wasn't shocked because we were in the same marriage and it wasn't good.
Right.
You know? And so, you know, he didn't, you know, again, he was devastated, but at the same time, he wasn't surprised. Right. And I think, you know, that's probably why we were able to put it back together because we both, it wasn't, you know, you hear about folks who have, marriages, but they're not even in the same marriage, right? They don't even like when one tells another that something, you know, that they've had an affair, they're so devastated because they didn't kind of see it coming. Right. And I think that with us, you know, at least he had the wherewithal to to be like, yeah, things haven't been good. And you know,
so did that give you guys the opportunity to say, okay, we've been through enough. We want to try to restart this. I mean, was there any kind of conversation of like, okay, I can't do this with you anymore?
Well, what we did, and I think this is also kind of, it was unique for us, which was we made one decision and that was the decision to not get a divorce. We didn't know how we were going to stay married. And in fact, I moved out. We lived apart. For a couple of years, but our whole thing was we're not going to get a divorce. And so let's try to figure out our way of actually trying to put this thing back together. And we might've ended up in divorce, but at that moment, I think we both could have said, we're done. It's over, divorce, but we didn't. So that was the one decision we made.
So I think people will find it interesting that I'm asking you this question, but I'm going to ask you this question. When did the affair start? Why did the affair start?
So the affair started, gosh, I think we had an affair like for 2 years. So it wasn't like, I mean, when I was having to come on TV and confess that I had this affair, I can still remember having some media consultants around who were like, just say that the affair started after Max's death and everybody will forgive you.
Right.
And it'll be fine. And I said, well, I know it's kind of ironic. I said, I'm actually not a liar and that's not true. But what you don't understand is that our marital problems started way before Max's death. Because if you have a child in crisis, you actually are trying to find a little bit of happiness. And I'm not making any excuses. I just happened to have this nice guy who sat next to me and he paid me attention and I was lonely. Mm. And, you know, and in a really vulnerable place and made really bad decisions on that.
And you just felt like it was someone who understood who you were in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those moments. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, at that point, the other thing too, and I talk a little bit about this in my book, but you know, one of the things that Bruce and I have always been really good at is running for office together, like campaigns in the campaign moment. You know, Bruce is always, he loves all the strategy and the numbers and stuff. But once I got elected, you know, I went to my work, like, you know, and he went back to his work. Like, these were jobs. And so, you know, and I never saw him. I mean, I literally worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so, where we were already at a point where we were struggling because we had issues with Max, you know, that gap became a lot wider because we were just never together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the night Max died, Bruce had said to me, you know, look, can we just go out? And like it used to be, like there's just the two of us, like no security detail, because I always had security detail with me. Like, no, like if any constituent walks up to you and says, like, I've got an issue, can you just please tell them to call you on Monday? Like, mm-hmm. can you please not take any selfies? Can we just have dinner together? And will you turn off your phone? And I did. I turned my phone to silent. And so we did. We had this magical, lovely night that night and connected and came home. And when I got home, I turned the phone back on and I saw that I'd missed a call from Max. And so I texted him back and said, hey, I saw I missed a call from you. You know, do you want me to call you back? Unbeknownst to me at that moment, you know, Max is dying on the back porch. Right. And, you know, and so it was the right thing to do to be present for my husband in that moment for that day. But I still think, God, what if I'd been available to take that call?
Right.
So.
Wow. That's such a, I mean, I have chills. I'm so sorry. That's terrible. But so how did you actually find out then? Did somebody, how were you called?
Yeah. So, we'd had a lovely evening out together. And so I would tell you, we were a little bit intoxicated. So at about 2 a.m, there is a loud knock on our door. And like every other family and every other situation, there are two police officers standing on our doorstep. And of course, at that moment, as I'm making my way downstairs in my, you know, pajamas to answer this door, and I open that door and I look, and then immediately I think something horrible has just happened in my city. Mm. Like there's a bomb. There's, you know, something, and I've got to run upstairs. I've got, okay, do I have time to brush my teeth? And, you know, what am I putting on? Like, you know,
right.
And all of these things are going through my head. And the police officer looked at me and said, I am so sorry. Max is gone. And I'm like, what? Like, no, like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And still I'm like, okay, you know, my, and finally he had to look at Bruce and say, Mr. Barry, I'm so sorry. Max is dead. So that's how we found out. Again, like countless other families, it's that knock in the middle of the night that you get that you never want to get.
Right. Of course, that you never want to get. No. And now, the guy that you had had the affair with, was he part? He was part of your security detail.
He was head of my security detail.
Yep. Right. So, and was he present for a lot of this aftermath?
Yep. Yeah,
for all of it.
In fact, he was the one who had to tell Bruce that our son had just overdosed on a, you know, back porch in Lakewood, Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
I know. Yeah.
Terrible stuff.
You know, and I'm again, like all so bad. And so, you know, again, like the, you know, and by me doing what I did, you know, not only did I impact my family, I impacted his family.
Sure.
And I am so sorry for that pain that I caused. In fact, you know, I was at a grocery store a couple, you know, months after I had left office and all this stuff. And there was a woman in an old pickup truck, and it was a really cool pickup truck. And I was like, hey, I love your pickup truck. And she looked at me and she's like, oh, it's you. And I was like, oh yeah. Like usually I can see this stuff coming. I didn't. And I'm like, yeah, it's me. And she's like, hey, she said, have you ever apologized to the woman whose husband you cheated with? And I was so pissed. I was like, damn it, you know, and I went inside the grocery store and I called my mom, and because my dad was a serial cheater. Mm-hmm. And I called my mom and I said, hey, mom, I said, would it have ever made a difference if one of the people that dad cheated with had ever apologized to you? And she thought about it for a second and she said, yeah, it would have. And I was like, wrong answer. That was not the answer I wanted. And then I called a friend of mine whose husband had cheated on her, and I asked her the same question, and she said, yes, it would have mattered. I was like, gosh. And so finally, you know, my mom's like, look, when you hurt people, you take responsibility and you say you're sorry. It doesn't mean that they have to ever accept your apology, and they may not, but it's up to you to say, and not the I'm sorry I hurt you bullshit, that I am sorry of what I did that caused you pain. And so, you know, that was part of my my
making
journey.
Amends. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So just incidentally, we know you're married still. Are they still married?
I don't know. Yeah, I hope so. I hope they were able to work it out. You know, again, it's, I hope so.
And then again, I'm curious, you know, when you're in a situation like that and the whole world finds out, and actually I'll ask you, cause I don't know how it got found out, but sure. You know, it's really hard to also sort of end those feelings. I mean, how did you decide, okay, regardless, this is what I'm going to choose, or it got so blown up that you realized you were not people you thought you were? Like, how did that pan out?
Well, I think, you know, it's funny. Like you said, we thought we were the best kept secret. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Secrets. Yeah. Yeah. And which is funny because I think about Max and his substance use disorder and secrets, just secrets all around, right? Like,
yeah.
Secrets are so bad for families and marriages and everything else. Anyway, the way somebody found out, honestly, I don't really know. But it, you know, it, but once it was like, even just being talked about,
right, the rumors.
I really felt like we have to, you know, like, I'm going to just own it, because that's what you should do. Like, if you, you know, and so, yeah, that didn't work out so well for me, but at the time I thought I can just like say this, it'll be fine. And again, I was,
well, honestly, did you feel like you could compartmentalize? Like, did you feel like this has nothing to do with my job? So
yes, I'm going to
have to, you know, apologize to my husband, make some amends there, but this has nothing to do with what I do on a daily basis.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I really, like, again, I was delusional. So yeah, I had this whole idea that I was going to be able to just put this in a box. We can deal with this. I'll, you know, do everything I need to do. And then I'll be able to move on. And in fact, you know, even months after I had left office, you know, some mornings I would wake up in that, like, that little twilight right before you're awake. Mm-hmm. And I would be thinking, okay, I think I've been punished enough now. I bet I can go back to the office.
Right. Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I do think that's such an interesting concept, because people want to put people who have been in a scandal, let's say, into this box that this is all that they amount to.
Yeah.
There was no before. There's no after. This is just who they are. And it seems like the biggest punishment, even more so than the act of anything happening, that you cannot get out of that box and you've lost all sense of credibility. And I don't know that a lot of people that haven't been through a public scandal that they can even fathom what that's like.
I completely agree. And you understand that.
Yeah.
So well, you know, so, you know, and I think you said something in something I was reading about you about being about the comma, you know, mm-hmm. about wanting to no longer be so-and-so, comma, and then whatever they decide to stick after that. Mm-hmm. And I really felt that. In fact, there was this moment of kind of like elation the first time I saw a news report about something I was doing and it didn't have the comma. Right. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, I guess
I'm back.
Right. Maybe somewhere, some way I don't have to have that for the rest of my life.
Right.
And, you know, and we're so bad about that for women. Right. I mean, because I got,
and that's why I asked you that earlier, because I think it's usually the women that can't let it go after the fact.
Interesting. Interesting that you say that. Yeah. Probably on some level.
Well, and I've learned that I think it's because it triggers something in them that they're dealing with. Whether it's their issue in their relationship, they've been cheated on, the secrets that, you know, are living in their world.
Yep.
And once you've gone through something like you or I, like, I don't have any skeletons in my closet.
Yeah,
I don't like it. I'm like, if I spit gum on the ground, I'll be like, wait, that was me. Let me pick it up. Like, I can't do anything.
Totally.
Because I'm like, I don't need somebody like turning this around and making it seem. So I am triggered by people that do have secrets or that seem like they're being shady, because I'm like, no, you can't do that around me. Cause I know that what that leads to. And I'm so transparent that it feels uncomfortable, and I notice it so easily. Do you feel like
totally
everywhere?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I just ran for Congress, right?
Yeah.
And got my butt kicked in November. But before I got into the race, everybody was like, oh God, you know, here we go. Like, you're going to have all this stuff. And I was like, well, there's nothing new. So it's, you know.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting? I think that a lot of people would say, well, you know, Megan, why are you going to run after all this happened?
Right.
I don't even see it that way, because why wouldn't you run? Because again, that is something that happened. You are really good at your job. So what, you know, people are going to ask that question, but like,
right,
ask one or two questions and let's move on and let's have a real conversation. Right. It's funny. I interviewed Anthony Weiner a couple months ago, and he's running for state, whatever he's running for. Council.
He's running.
Yeah. Council. Yeah. And he talks about, you know, he's made amends just like you. He's taken responsibility. He's done all these things to atone. He's worked on himself. And then he's like, listen, at the end of the day, I don't owe anyone an apology anymore besides my wife and like whatever my immediate issues are. And I've worked that out. We're friends. You know, they got a divorce, but, you know, they co-parent and it is what it is. And it's really nobody's business. And if other people have an issue, that's really their issue at this point.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a super smart guy. He cares so much about New York. And, you know, I don't know why it wouldn't make sense for you to get back into politics.
Right.
I love that you wrote a book. You know, I love the title. It's What You Do Next. And I think that so many people get stuck in that first act. They don't know how to move to the second act.
Right.
They sit on a shelf as a discounted version of themselves because they don't know how to tarnish them, you know, get that tarnish off and be like, okay, you know, here we go. Because those voices are in your head of that comma, you know, whatever it is. And I feel like that's relatable. You don't have to be in a public scandal to have people that feel that shame and that guilt or whatever it is.
Absolutely.
And I love that you wrote a book that you tell the whole story, but you also explain how to get out of it. You explain how, you know, like, you know, how to live your life again.
Yeah. Because it is what you do next. It's not what you did. It's what you do next.
Right.
And you know that too. Like, and when we look at the scandals, and I think that having the public scandal is one thing, but everybody has people in their circles who are talking about stuff, who are, you know, that it's all there.
Right.
And we're all, you know, all, as you said, all the secrets.
Right. And everybody deserves a second chance.
They do. And women especially. And again, I go back to, we're so good at canceling women oftentimes because we do hold women, you know, like, hey, if a guy had done, well, there was a mayor in Nashville who actually had an affair with his security detail, who was a woman, and like, no harm, no foul.
Right.
So,
anyone even heard of that story? I mean,
no, of course not. Right. Because nobody cared.
Right.
And you know, again, whatever. It's I just think that we're so oftentimes so much harder on women. But this has been such a great conversation.
I know, it's so fun. And you know, I feel like that your book is just so timeless and it's great. Where can people get your book?
So you can get it on Amazon, you can get it at your local bookstores, you can get it you know, wherever books are sold. So,
and I will ask you, just because I have to ask everyone at the end of my show, what do you think is the most misunderstood thing about you?
The most misunderstood thing about me is that somehow, because of what I did, that I am not a moral and ethical person.
Okay. I love that. And what is the biggest takeaway you want people to get from your book?
Oh, I want them to know that you can have a second chance. You know, when I ran for office, with those little girls, like they were so excited to see a woman running for mayor. What I want them to now know is, look, you can make some really serious mistakes and you can still put your life back together. And I hope I can be an inspiration now on that end.
Yeah, great. All right. It's What You Do Next by Megan Berry. You can get that book now. And I appreciate you. Where can people look you up? Where can they get in touch with you?
Sure.
What's your handles?
Sure. So I have all kinds of handles. So you can find me on Instagram at Mayor Megan Berry. You can find me at my website, meganberry.com. You can find me on X at Megan C. Berry. You can find me on Substack at Mayor Megan Berry. Try Mayor Megan Berry. That'll be usually the one that will work.
Perfect. And last question, do you think you will ever get into politics again?
I don't know. This last race was was pretty hard. But you know what? You can't have a democracy unless you have people run for office. So whatever side of the coin you're on, people need to participate.
I love that. Well, whatever you decide to do, I'm on your side. I'm a fan. And I wish you the best of luck.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.